This is February 25th, 2003, calling the House Water Committee into session, and we're going to skip a little down one on the agenda and start with a public hearing on House Bill 2138.
All right, House Bill 2138 defines terms for purposes of the Oregon Plan.
That's pretty quick,
I'd like to say the bill was simple, but it's okay. More complex than that.
And we'll have, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the chairman of the task force that worked on this come forward and present for us the bill and its purposes and background. Good morning.
Good morning.
Bob. Who's going to lead off? Are you?
I'll lead off.
Yes.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Bob Jacobson. I live in Newport, Oregon. I was one of the 13 members of the Salmon Recovery Task Force created by the 2001 Legislative Assembly as a result of House Bill 3002. It was my privilege to have served as chair of that group. I'm here today to provide you with basically the same overview of the committee and its recommendations that I gave you a month ago when I testified before you. Our recommendations and much of the many of the activities that the task force were involved in are in our final report. I think you have a copy of that final report in front of you, or at least you had one last meeting. Mm-hmm. Of the 13 committee members, we had two state representatives. Both Representative Jensen and Dingfelder were very active participants in that process, as was Senator Messley. We had five people from state agencies, one representing the commercial fishing industry, another the recreational fishing industry, one from the tribes, one from an environmental group, and one from a local government. In addition, the task force was extremely fortunate to have the services of members of the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, or IMST, particularly its co-chair, Stan Gregory. His advice and input were invaluable. The National Marine Fisheries Service staff was also in attendance and participated in each of the five meetings. Finally, Ed Bowles, who's sitting alongside me today, and Ed is chief of fisheries for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, provided excellent support and direction during the process. After I conclude my remarks, you'll hear from Ed about how this ties in with the Oregon Plan. Section 18 of House Bill 3002 directed the task force to, number one, define recovery, number two, develop and coordinate a scientific workshop with IMST, number three, establish criteria for evaluation of salmon recovery, and number four, develop legislation for recommendation to the 72nd Legislative Assembly. The full task force met five times during 2002. In addition, the chair appointed several subcommittees of that group that met periodically. Our meetings are open to the public, and the public's comments were solicited. Virtually all of our meeting time was directed towards coming up with the definition of the word recovery. I told the committee early on that I felt the definition must be biologically defensible, politically palatable, and one which the public had at least some reasonable chance of understanding. As a committee, we struggled initially, and I'll be the first to admit I underestimated the difficulty of trying to come up with a definition for the word that everyone can agree to. Finally, as we reached the 11th hour of our final meeting, we were able to generate that definition, and that definition can be found on page 2 of the final report or in House Bill 2138. Our second assignment was to develop and coordinate a meeting on salmon recovery with IMST. That 1.5-day meeting was held July 1st and 2nd in Corvallis and was attended by over 30 of the top scientists in the region. A portion of that workshop was was to develop parameters for the definition of the word recovery. The proceedings of the workshop provided an enlightening insight into the thinking of many of the key players involved in salmon recovery in the region. Our third charge under HBL 3002 was to establish criteria for evaluation of salmon recovery. The task force, however, simply had neither the time nor the resources to complete the work necessary to recommend to you those criteria. Several technical processes are currently underway to complete the task described in our final report. The need for such criteria remains very, very viable. Our last goal was to prepare legislation, House Bill 2138, as a result. Thank you.
Any questions for Bob this morning? It's okay, you can ask questions. Okay, we'll go to Ed Bowles with the Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And as Bob mentioned, we're very active participants in the development of this definition of recovery and are very supportive of House Bill 2138. And I have a written testimony related to the department's support of the bill, and just summarize it in saying that this has been a very critical piece that we think is necessary in the puzzle of recovery actions. In fact, our native fish conservation policy has left a placeholder within it awaiting this definition to come to fruition. And so rather than duplicating this or coming up with something different within our own internal process, instead we waited to see what came up here, and we will insert this through administrative rule directly into our native fish conservation policy as well. So we appreciate the work of the task force. I wanted to mention that the way this came about through this collaborative process that was set up last session really represents the approach, this sort of collaborative approach to fish and wildlife conservation that Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife really strongly endorses, and we hope to see more and more of this sort of approach to dealing with these issues. So basically we urge passage of the bill, and I have a brief PowerPoint presentation just to describe the definition itself, and then give a brief glimpse of what the definition means on the ground with respect to an actual recovery plan that this sort of concept was used in relative to Lower Columbia River coho. Michael, I just need the... We're ready here, if we can get it on the screen.
Maybe the place of line. It's really hard to see.
So where you just...
Let me try this.
Oh, this here needs to be turned on. I need to borrow my hammer.
I'm loading my hammer.
Well, Chair, I have it on my screen.
The beauties of modern technology.
I can turn the screen around.
And we have.
I'll go ahead and try.
People who are otherwise challenged in that area.
Hit F4.
I tried that.
Is that working?
We'll do it again.
Try it again.
Somehow the screen isn't talking to the computer this morning.
I will reboot and see if that helps.
Yeah, I'm fine. It's coffee down there.
Technology is wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Great. Gotta get the technological
the
pieces speaking for each other.
Committee will stand at ease for a few minutes, a few here.
Check this.
back in a session, and our technical problems at least seem to be solved at this point. We're waiting for the computer startup to get through. Pete, I now understand why you left us quite a bit of time for this presentation. Your wisdom continues to impress me.
Me too.
It was a dumb luck.
Yeah, I think you caught it. Dumb luck, yeah.
The elbows are fake leftovers.
I had some real concern.
Maybe there are times.
It was a much awful place. It was a funding stream designed for specific purposes, and I'm not quite sure I bought it.
I'll refund my
So there is a problem there.
No.
But I haven't seen some great stage as well.
There is one.
If we just came out with a message, then we should
be pretty close to starting
today.
Okay. Chair Jensen and committee members, thank you for your patience. Once again, Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. House Bill 2138 basically, you can boil it down to the definition of recovery. I'll read this briefly for you. Recovery means that the constituent populations of naturally produced fish belonging to a listed unit are sufficiently abundant, productive, and diverse in terms of life histories and distribution that the listed unit as a whole will be self-sustaining into the future. It's kind of a mouthful, so I'm going to walk you through a couple key terms within this that are important. There's actually, I think, four within the bill that are further defined, but I think two of them are the key ones. One of those is naturally produced fish. What does that mean? And the other is self-sustaining. Naturally produced fish defined as fish that reproduce and complete their full life cycle in natural habitats. And self-sustaining is defined as populations are able to survive prolonged periods of poor ocean climatic and environmental conditions. And the second part to that is that habitat is of sufficient quality and quantity to provide survival rates adequate for the persistence of naturally produced fish populations that provide associated environmental, cultural, and economic benefits. Now, just to give you, a glimpse of what this means on the ground, this is the recovery definition in action.
Wait, for a minute. Sure. Let me ask a question. There is nothing in this definition of recovery that you've been through, if you go back to that, Ed, that speaks negatively to the issue of hatchery fish. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, this uses as the currency for delisting is naturally produced fish, which is the requirement of the federal ESA, which this bill was geared towards. In getting towards recovery of naturally produced fish, that does not preclude the use of hatchery fish and hatcheries to aid in that effort. Hatchery fish, adults, salmon and steelhead that spawn in natural habitats and produce offspring are naturally produced offspring. They would be the current C4 delisting, correct?
Okay. Thank you.
This example is for Lower Columbia River coho, which is a state-listed species under the state ESA. There are basically six populations identified on the Oregon side for Lower Columbia River coho. And in getting at the definition which called for sufficient abundance, for one of the criteria we wanted to show you for that particular species in that particular area, what does that mean? Delisting criteria then for that selected for Lower Columbia River coho are 50% of the spawners that are required to fully seed the habitat for three consecutive years. And we don't need to debate too much exactly whether or not that is the exact right criteria, but the purpose here in this context is that this definition will require specific standards and criteria for these attributes, such as abundance, distribution, and diversity. In this particular one, it's 50% of the spawners needed to seed the habitat for 3 years. You also have a productivity persistent sort of attribute required in the definition. The delisting criteria for Lower Columbia River coho.
Mr. Bowles, what are these numbers on the abundance? What do these numbers mean, 670 and 1,900?
Chair Jensen and Representative Schaffler, that is the actual number of adults required to come back in the Sandy River and the Clackamas River that represents half of the number that would be needed to fully seed the habitat.
That's not a lot. That's not a lot of fish, is it?
No, it's not. These are smaller systems for coho.
Thank you.
On the survival or productivity persistence attribute, the delisting criteria is less than 5% probability of extinction in 36 years. I'll explain a little bit on what goes into that one in a minute. And then you have a distribution criteria in the definition that plays out on the ground for coho as 65% of the name streams populated. In other words, presence of coho naturally produced in 65% of the streams, the Sandy and Clackamas being self-sustaining within that, and then two out of the remaining four populations also self-sustaining.
Ed, mm-hmm. A question here. Have we used Lower Columbia River coho as an example? And my understanding is, yes, as I read your slides. But can you apply this formula to Chinook, Columbia River Chinook, or any other?
Chair Jensen, the other species that are currently listed would all follow this definition in the same way, in that for the species, for the geographic area that you're drawing your circle around to recover, you would come up with specific standards for them to clear in order to be delisted, the same as you would here. And the exact formula for that will be a little different for each species,
okay.
And that's why the definition didn't dictate in statute, so to speak, exactly what that formula is for the standard, because it's going to be a little different depending on where you're at. And we didn't want a one-size-fits-all statewide one that all species and all streams would have to adhere to. So this will be custom-tailored to the individual species and their watersheds.
So if we are talking about the Umatilla Chinook, we would not have the same kind of numbers. It would be unique to the Umatilla and to Chinook. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, that's correct. You may select the same 50% of full seeding, but the absolute numbers would be quite different.
Yes.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffer. Or Flores.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Bowles, and then
Sandy and Clackamas self-sustaining, is that the 50% of the spawners criteria for self-sustaining?
Chair Jensen and Representative Floyd, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Forgive me, I'm a layman in this, so... the number is 670 and 1900. That, and maybe that's just the question Representative Flores just asked. That represents the amount at 50%, or that's 100%, and we need half of those?
Chair Jensen and Representative Schaffler, that is the 50%.
And, may I, again? And then I know there's probably a whole book written on this, but how do you get 670 and 1900? Can you tell me that in a couple sentences, or is that...
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, it's based on, let's maybe use a parallel of if you're in agribusiness and you have a certain amount of beef cattle that you're going to pasture. It's the amount of fully seeding it where you're getting the maximum productivity out of that herd that would represent. So it's what the habitat can support in such a way that you're not reducing the survival and production of that herd. And so that represents the full seeding. And then we ratchet that back to 50% of that for delisting.
Mathematical calculation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would assume without that reference we're talking about cross fencing then, since how he's bringing cattle into this.
Just, their technology is not quite there.
Okay.
I think we will.
Chair Jensen, I just wanted to show you now an example with respect to this Lower Columbia River Coho of actually the data now of how we're doing getting towards delisting. The dashed line that you see here is the delisting criteria for the sandy population. Remember, for just the abundance piece of this would require 3 consecutive years
above the line.
You can see that we're doing quite well in that regard, but remember, this is just one of the attributes that define recovery. We also have to look at the persistence and abundance and distribution one. But it's very encouraging what we've seen in recent times, and I'll show you why that's occurring. Now, let's look at the survivability one. This shows that anything above the dashed line is in a growth mode for the population. Anything below the dashed line is in a decline mode for the population. In other words, they're not producing enough parents to replace enough progeny to replace the parents. You can see also that in recent 3 years we are at or above the line for this data set, and very encouraging on that as well. The reason, one of the reasons, other than a shift, much better ocean conditions that are helping, but an actual management change that occurred in order to get this recovery of definition in action towards delisting, was a dramatic change in the amount of fish that we were harvesting in the Lower Columbia River Coho of these naturally produced fish. We went from over 80% of the fish coming back being taken out in the fisheries, we're now down to typically less than 20%, 15 to 20% in the fisheries as a result of selectively marking the hatchery fish and focusing on those. It's been a very strong player in the response of these Lower Columbia River coho.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, Ed, when you're back, you're talking about the number of smolts leaving the system and making an estimate based on that as to the returning adults for sustainability. Do you have data over time to connect the assumptions to the reality? In other words, do you understand the question?
yes, Chair Jensen and Representative Cruz, this data set that you see in front of you right here represents the actual adults produced from their parental adults. And so this,
okay,
this actually represents...
This is based on what returns...
Adults to adults.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This just shows how we're approaching hatcheries. Chair Jensen, you brought up this question earlier. Does this definition preclude the use of hatcheries as a recovery tool? This shows this definition in action in the Lower Columbia. The stars represent where the hatcheries currently are. The kind of pink or fuchsia color is the areas of high hatchery influence allowed. Other areas in the blue, these mid-tribs, Scappoose and Kloskinine, those are, represent the hatcheries as a recovery tool. These are areas that were knocked way back during those extensive fishery periods. And then we also have some areas within the range of these fish that'll have minimal hatchery influence. Currently, these are above areas where we can get our hands on the fish, Barry's Marmot Dam and others in Sandy. So you have kind of a whole mix of management approaches to this. Intensive hatchery influence, hatcheries as a conservation tool, we're actually rebuilding the population with hatcheries, and then other areas where we're focusing on other management actions and not allowing a lot of hatchery influence. So it's a real mixed bag, which is we wouldn't be able to do this if we had a one-size-fits-all approach towards recovery and wouldn't be able to custom tailor it like this to meet the needs of the fish in their watersheds. So
what's the dark green in here?
Go.
You got two greens, a light and...
Yes, the dark green, Chair Jensen, is actually areas above complete barriers that we were able to exclude. We determine what goes above those areas, whereas the light green are areas that over time will be much more open to straying and other things.
Mr. Chair, and could we assume those are natural barriers? Or
no.
Those are dams then? Okay.
Okay.
That's all I have, Chair Jensen.
Any questions for Mr. Bolt? Any questions for Bob and the task force?
I do have one question, please.
Yes.
Just for my own, how many hours do you think were spent coming up with this definition if you added up every individual's hours? I just want to know how much time you spent on this.
Chair Jensen, representation.
Don't add your hours in.
I had to talk about it from that standpoint, but we did have 5 meetings at the full committee. There were 13 people on the committee. We had 3 or 4 subcommittee meetings. We spent a day and a half in Corvallis in a workshop. We put countless hours into putting that workshop together. I personally traveled to Sun River at my own expense during that time to listen to a half day's presentation on salmon recovery at the American Fisheries Society meeting. I could figure those hours out, but it was a bunch.
It's hundreds.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Conservative hundreds.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question, if I may.
Yes, if you.
Thank you. Ed, I'm going back to the dark green that you said was above the dams. Are there fish up there? How can they get above the dams? Are there fish ladders?
Chair Jensen and Representative Tomei, yes, there is passage provided at those areas.
Mm-hmm. Fish ladders, is that
yes.
What you're saying?
Okay. Or areas to trap the fish, and then we haul them above.
Okay. So, and the ones that you would haul up would be the naturally produced...
That is correct.
...puppy hatcher, obviously. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, the Chair would like to make a couple of comments in relationship to the testimony and in relationship to the IMST. The history of this is that we did in the last session introduce the enabling legislation for this task force to be convened. We did that as a consequence of one of IMST's technical reports that they gave to us. And the report was that fundamentally before you can do anything, you have to have a definition of recovery. I'm oversimplifying, and excuse me for, you know, for doing that. As a consequence of that report and the fact that the definition of recovery then was going to be important for us as we move through the probably yet muddy waters of this whole issue of the ESA, we proceeded with this, and this is the definition that, you know, that came out of it. And I would like to remind you that you have in front of you testimony on House Bill 2138 from the members of the IMST. Mr. Stan Gregory, who was with us through most of, if not all, I'm not sure, Bob, I missed a session.
Just about all
of the sessions of the task force, is presenting us, you know, this letter. And I think maybe the crucial part of it comes in the last paragraph, where he says the task force has carefully developed a definition of salmon recovery that we, IMST, believe is consistent with concepts and requirements of the Endangered Species Act, two, the needs of the Oregon Plan for salmon and watersheds, and three, the importance of Oregon's valuable natural resource. This definition is technically sound and will assist the states as it evaluates the status of its salmonid resources and the effectiveness of the Oregon Plan. And I certainly think we need some way to evaluate the effectiveness of the Oregon Plan, because it occupies a substantial amount of printed pages in the statutes that we have. And the more printed pages you have in the statutes, the more money you're likely to be spending with it. So the IMST appreciates the interest of the legislature, Governor's Austin, and Task Force in this contribution. With that, if anyone has any questions of...
I have a question for you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Is this going to be used with the federal government to show that we are working toward restoring these populations and getting us off the endangered species listing?
It certainly would be our intention, but I'll let Ed speak to that. He may be better positioned to do so.
Chair Jensen and Representative Tomei, this definition is consistent with where both the now called NOAA Fisheries, National Marine Fisheries Service, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are heading in their technical recovery teams with defining recovery as well. Bob can speak to this perhaps better than me, but I'm pretty certain that at least NOAA Fisheries was present at several of the task force meetings, working with the group to ensure that this group didn't diverge from federal government requirements for ESA delisting.
Thank you.
They were active participants in each one of our five committee meetings, as they were in our 1.5-day workshop in Cabela's.
Follow up. Do they have a definition that is consistent with theirs, or do they have a definition at all?
I'll turn that one back to Ed.
Chair Jensen and Representative Tomei, I'm not aware that they have a distinct definition of recovery per se. I do know that through the workshop and the meetings that this is essentially where all the management entities are landing with respect to the key attributes that would be used to define recovery.
And is that going to be their responsibility to come up with a definition that is hopefully consistent with this definition, so that we know when we reach recovery? In other words, are they required to come up with something specific that we can aim toward?
Chair Jensen and Representative Tomei, they aren't necessarily required to come up with wording such as this. They are required to come up with standards for each group of fish that they have listed that will be used to measure success. And that has been a multi-year-long process that they've been under in numerous areas, trying to come up with exactly what those standards are. This will help them focus those standards in on these key attributes the same way we will be doing in our state under the Oregon plan.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? We are temporarily going to, close the public hearing on House Bill 2138 and open the public hearing, on 2346. I think this is the one Senator Messerly is here to testify on, and in order to allow him to make best use of his time, we won't.
You said 36, it's 2266.
Excuse me, it's 2366, I believe. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ken Messerly, for the record, Senator from District 5. Appreciate the opportunity and appreciate your breaking in like this and to allow me to testify. This task force on the water supply and conservation, where this bill came from, was first known as Senate Bill 93. It was established in 1999. Senator Tarnow and myself sponsored that bill, like I say, in 1999, to work in consultation with the Water Resource Department and develop recommendations relating to the process of siting and funding future water supply projects. As you can see, I'm the co-chair with Mr. Chair. I'm the co-sponsor with Chair Jensen on behalf of the Task Force on Water Supply and Conservation. The task force has focused its attention on evaluating issues, opportunities, and constraints associated with two policy objectives. Number one, developing new supply options. And number two, making the most efficient use of the existing supplies, conservation. The availability of this information will be critical as water users make long-term water supply plans and will provide local governments an opportunity to identify and protect potential future storage sites. It will also support economic development and environmental quality activities in Oregon. Surface water storage is a key component of a diversified long-term water supply strategy. It's an extensive process, long overdue, that we identify these sites and help the communities move forward. This bill will provide for a comprehensive, up-to-date, and accessible inventory of potential surface water storage sites in the state. The task force supports the passage of House Bill 2366.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Messer? Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Senator. Couple questions. Does this inventory include in-stream as well as off-stream sites? In other words, would this show us potential in-stream impoundments, not just off-surface storage capability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I'm almost positive this is simply off storage sites.
Off-stream
sites, yeah.
Okay. And the reason I bring that up is there is some potential for. I've always been a big supporter of dams, Mr. Chair, as most people know. The other question, Mr. Chair, would be I'm looking at the dollar figure in here. Do you think the chair of the Natural Resources Subcommittee will look on this favorably?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we have to have a discussion with the department on that.
Okay.
But as you know, the general fund is going to be extremely tight. Matter of fact, I'm spending all of my time trying to find release general fund for other uses in this. So I think it's the right idea. It's the right policy. We simply need to do some work on finding the funding for it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Other questions for Senator Messer? Thank you very much,
Thank
Senator.
You very much.
I appreciate you working around our schedule, and I'm sorry we weren't ready when you got here first time. Thank you. At this point, we will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2366. temporarily close, excuse me, to correct that on the record. We'll get back to it momentarily. And before we proceed on, I am pleased that Representative Krupp has joined us, and we have the chair request the committee unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that Representative Flores and Representative Krupp be allowed to vote on the motion to send House Bill 2247 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, could you amend that to allow me to vote also?
You didn't vote?
No. You did that today? I wouldn't.
No, not today. That was the last. You voted on that, Jeff.
It was last Thursday.
Okay, 47. Okay, never mind.
Okay.
But if you want to vote again, I mean, I think it would be.
Vote early, vote often.
I'm trying to find ways to vote twice, and that maybe that'll carry over, but anyway.
I mean, two yes votes for, you know, for Jeff could be a real plus. hearing no objections, Representative Flores, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Flores votes aye. Representative Krupp, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Krupp votes aye. Thank you very much. That agenda item is then taken care of. We'll go back and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2138 at this point. And we have Bill Mushofsky for Oregonians in Action and Save the Salmon Coalition is here to testify on this bill. Bill, welcome.
Welcome. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bill Mushofsky. Excuse my voice, got a little cold here. I'm with Oregonians in Action, also co-chair of the Save the Salmon Coalition, which is a broad-based group of resource, land use, building industry, fishing interests, including the Oregon Farm Bureau, the realtors, the cattlemen, home builders, the building industry, Wheat Growers League, Oregon Anglers Coalition for Fisheries Enhancement. Our goal is to not just worry about recovery, it's to seek optimum populations of both hatchery and naturally produced fish for all the purposes they're needed for. Today we're testifying on this bill. With all due respect to all the work that's been done on the task force and to my friend Ed Bowles, we have concerns with this bill. Number one, we question, you know, the propriety of the state attempting to determine what recovery is under the federal law. Secondly, we think it's premature to try to determine that because NOAA Fisheries NIMS has not yet reached a decision. Regardless of what you may have heard, the matter is still undecided as to what the role of hatchery fish is and whether they should be counted or not. The staff from NOAA Fisheries has been involved, but they cannot speak for the NOAA Fisheries because the decision has not been made. The initial hatchery policy came out some time ago only for reaction from state government and from the tribes. It's not available yet for public comment. We understand it's undergoing major surgery. Also, we believe that aside from all of that, the proposed recovery definition ignores hatchery bred salmon, focuses only on naturally produced salmon, and we believe hatchery fish should be counted and considered as the same as the naturally produced fish from the same populations. They're more than a tool. They're a part of our basic salmon populations, a large part. Of course, Judge Hogan held that they should be counted in it's a federal court case. Both NOAA and ODF&W and the state policy agrees that they're the same fish. Hatchery fish spawned from native fish are native fish. Also, as Ed said to you this morning, that if a hatchery bred fish spawns in the wild, the progeny from that activity are wild fish or natural fish. Also, a group of independent fishery scientists, 10 of them, outstanding men who have spent their lives in academia, in actual experience dealing with these issues, have prepared a draft paper that is going to be submitted to NOAA, NF, National Marine Fisheries, which addresses this issue as to whether hatchery fish should be counted. They are not in the pay of anybody. They are volunteers. They do not speak for special interests. They speak for themselves because they're deep concerns about the policies that are being pursued in this arena. I've reviewed the draft, and it's a powerful paper. I think that makes a powerful case for the fact that hatchery fish should be counted and urging NOAA fisheries to count them. It's not quite ready for publication, but we urge that at least this committee holds up any action until you've heard from them and had a chance to review that paper. I think it's important. There's a lot of politics, as you know, in this wild fish, hatchery fish issue. And I think we're making progress. Our coalition participated in the Native Fish Conservation Policy Task Force. I think we had 9-10 all-day meetings, and I think we came up with a pretty good result. We're pleased with the direction that Director Lindsey Ball and Ed Bowles are taking with their policies, and we're going to be working with them to assure that they have funding to carry out the policy that they have adopted. But I believe that one shortcoming is there's still some anti-hatchery bias in that, and I think that some of that bias is reflected in this proposed policy. And again, I say that it's not consistent really with how we treat hatchery fish, and it's not consistent with what we think the direction, ultimate direction of NIMS. I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Mischofsky. When will this draft report be in final?
Oh, it should be any day.
Any day.
Any day. I'd hope to have it today, but there's one little question they want to work out, some legal point that they want to clarify. So I'll be sure to get it to the committee, whether it's in a hearing or not. I'll be happy to provide it.
Okay. Any other questions? Maybe just a something of an observation, Bill. And take it as a question. You can certainly respond to it. But one of the problems that we've had, and especially in the Oregon plan, is that there is no definition of recovery. And I know that we've talked about this a number of other times, that as it exists at the present time, it's a moving goalpost that there's no way to get your arms around. While it is true that the state of Oregon cannot mandate or dictate to the federal government the issue of what is and what is not recovery, no one else anywhere else has come up with a definition of recovery, and of course in part we have our own Endangered Species Act that we're dealing with or can be dealing with this, and secondly if we are and if we continue to be successful with the efforts that we're making under the Oregon plan, we provide a substantial influence in NOAA fisheries to look more carefully at the definition that we have. As you are aware, the anti-hatchery bias that we have seen has been something that the chair has worked at for a long time to try to minimize that or try to do away with that. And we did specifically try to ask the department to have it on record. Maybe we didn't use the right wording, but we'll be happy to use the anti-hatchery wording when the Fish and Wildlife come back to further testify on this bill.
I fully appreciate your concerns, Mr. Chairman. However, I feel that the definition is really so vague here that it really can't be of much use. It's subject to a lot of interpretation, as Ed indicated, that they'll have different criteria for each population or each situation, and maybe that's the way it has to be. But I feel, just from reading this, putting my lawyer hat on, that it'd be very general and sounds good, but probably doesn't mean a lot. And I think that, we're very much opposed to the concept of counting only naturally produced fish. And this is we think, when you realize that 80-90% of the fish out there are hatchery bred, and that they have the same survival skills, they have the same reproductive skills, and the geneticists tell you that they're basically the same fish, providing they come from the same stock, the same populations. And so I'm not sure how far down the field this particular action would take you. And I, from our point of view, that we would be very unhappy about the fact that the state of Oregon taking positions contrary to what we're trying to get NIMS to take, which is to count hatchery fish, as Judge Hogan said that they should. So I feel that while it's all well intended, that overall we have problems with the policy.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bill, excuse me. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2138 here? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2138 and we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2366. Directs the Water Resource Department to... Excuse me. Staff.
That's all right. You're doing fine. House Bill 2366 directs the Water Resource Department to prepare inventory of potential surface water storage sites in the state, appropriates monies, declares emergency effective on passage. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, and I think we heard Representative Cruz address the topic of the referral to Ways and Means, and the fact that getting new revenue for something new as far as programs are concerned is going to be in this biennium probably very difficult to come by. We have a couple of people signed up. Let's take Rich Angstrom. Are you here first in the testimony? Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I apologize for slight disorganization this morning. I'm trying to handle multiple committees and multiple bills today. For some reason, they all just kind of heaped up on us.
Fortunately, you don't have a PowerPoint presentation.
That's it. Yeah,
you may have missed that in here, but we had a
technical
difficulties with the PowerPoint presentation. So,
Mr. Chair, I've been trying to run back and forth between a couple of committees, so I've been in and out most of the morning here. The one bill that I wanted to bring some testimony on is the one that Water Resources Department is looking at as far as inventorying the potential the potential reservoir sites around the state to look at connecting the water resources of the state that are available. One of the things that I think from the aggregate community side is in the area of aggregate, when we dig pits and in some places quarries, what we end up with is a water body. And right now, the present law doesn't allow us to reclaim sites to potential reservoir sites. And I would like to support this bill because I think in the interim, one of the things we should look at, there'd have to be some legislative changes to allow the aggregate industry to do that. But just, you know, off the top, thinking about it, it's a significant possibility to increase the storage of water around the state using the aggregate sites. And our membership could take advantage of that as far as a reclamation of these pits for reservoirs. Now, it will take a legislative change because under current law, we're only allowed to reclaim either back to a farm use, to some industrial use, or to some fish and wildlife habitat. The advantage, frankly, from my side of it is I think the reclamation side to a water storage facility would be a cheaper reclamation cost for our members, and if it could be connected somehow to the municipalities or something of that nature, there might be a huge advantage for the state. There's a lot of opportunity in this bill, and I'd like to get some support in favor of it.
Thank you. Any questions for Rich?
Yes.
Please.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Rich, what in this bill would help you achieve what it is you would like?
Well, I think it's about the inventorying process of the reservoirs that are out there, and basically a study to go out and look at what's available and how we can utilize the different reservoirs, whether they're inventoried now or not, obviously this is going to take some interim work on our part, but certainly getting the Water Resources Department looking at this issue, looking at the different opportunities, and help us develop a reclamation way, a reclamation plan, how we would do this. Because there's all sorts of, you know, just problems with it. One of the big ones is that you have to think through is in the case of pits where you have unconsolidated alluvial gravels, those are connected hydraulically to the groundwater. And so you'd have to think through that, are these really storage or is it just pass through of groundwater? Maybe we can seal it somehow. But those are the kinds of things that we need to engage with the Department of Water Resources as well as Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, see if there's some opportunity that we can reclaim these things in a way that provides for more water, available water for all sorts of purposes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Schaffner.
Currently, you're not allowed to use reclaimed quarries and mines for water storage for industry?
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate your being here today.
You bet. Thank you.
Then we have Adam Sussman and Paul Cleary from the Water Resource Department.
They're concerned about the funding.
Okay, good morning, gentlemen.
I think we can close that down. We don't have a PowerPoint either.
You don't have a PowerPoint either. Darn, we were looking for more, more excitement in here.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cleary, Director of the Oregon Water Resource Department. With me is Adam Sussman, a Senior Policy Coordinator and staff to our Senate Bill 93 Task Force. You heard from the chair of our task force, Senator Messerly, about this being a bill that had the support of the task force members. It's a necessary part of our effort to develop a comprehensive water supply strategy for Oregon that combines surface water storage, groundwater storage, water conservation efficiency, and transfers of existing water rights. Obviously, as Senator Messerly indicated, developing new water supply is key to our supporting economic development and environmental quality activities in the state. this has been identified as a need for the state since the early 1990s, this need to have a single entity collect, evaluate, and make available information regarding potential storage sites. We had it in earlier budget request, 1999 and 01, as part of what we called a stewardship and supply package, a much bigger package that unfortunately, because of the funding problems, wasn't able to make it through the process. It also was a recommendation of the Governor's Task Force on Storage in 1998. We're not looking at reinventing the wheel. We just want to update and quality assure the existing information. We want to evaluate all types of sites. As you indicated, Representative Cruz, there's the primary opportunities are probably going to be off-channel sites, but there are some on-channel sites. And we're also going to look at the expansion potential for existing sites. We've seen a lot of that here recently because that is some of the most cost-effective and environmentally effective ways to improve your water supply. We've had it occur down in Coos Bay, North Bend with Upper Pony Creek.
Yeah.
The cities of Hillsborough, Forest Grove, and Beaverton have expanded Barney Reservoir. City of McMinnville has expanded McGuire Reservoir. We're looking at things down in Klamath with Gerber. And so existing sites, off-channel, on-channel, as well as opportunities such as Rich Angstrom indicated to try to use some of the natural storage capabilities of things like pits and side channels and so forth. That's sometimes a real cost-effective approach as well. And then we just want to put this information in an easily accessible format for planners, for cities and counties, and for other water users to be able to access and consider as they start developing their long-term supplies. We understand the problem with the general fund. I'd spoke with Senator Messley about how we're out talking with both the Corps of Engineers and the Natural Resource Conservation Service trying to see whether we'd be eligible for some federal funding, and it may be that when we get this working through the Ways and Means, we'd be looking at an expenditure limitation for federal funding. I'm one, though, that believes real strongly in under-promising and over-delivering, and I can't do this within existing resources, but I can commit that if we can find funding from some source, we can do it. With that, be open for questions. And
thank you, Paul. Any questions for Paul? Adam, did you have anything you were going to add?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if it's a question for you or for Paul or Adam, but you know, $150,000 is not a huge amount of money. I know Kathy was just talking about how this would help them too. It's too bad that we can't generate funds. Maybe I'm fearful this is going to go to Ways and Means and die. It's too bad we can't find some way of generating funds, if it's not federal, but maybe even private funds,
right,
to do this.
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, we certainly could look at an expenditure limitation that would be a combination of both federal funds and other funds. So if there were entities that wanted to contribute to it, because most of the federal funds require a cost share. And we've done that before where we've gone out and worked with industry, water users, and communities to come up with the state's cost share through their money. So that's a good idea in terms of expanding the ability to cast the net, if you will.
So if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, maybe asking you, I guess I'm not fully cognizant of what the process would be. So if this goes to Ways and Means kills it because of the fiscal. Can we keep it alive with other funds?
The probable thing, worst-case scenario, would be, I think, that Ways and Means might fund it with a dollar in order to allow the department and the private sector to step up. I mean, if we decide to send it to Ways and Means because it is a good policy issue. You know, I would see that as probably, you know, one of the scenarios that might come out. Or they might, and then they might, if they got a little bit more money, leave something in the e-board that if they could get, you know, that there'd be some cushion there. But Representative Cruz.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I think when I looked at the bill and I looked at the chief sponsor of the bill, is the chair of that sub, and I think Paul was right. I think at the very least we could do another fund limitation here, so that if there were some federal funds that became available, and I think it's important that we send it to Ways and Means so that they have the ability to be creative in different ways of getting funds. And clearly at this point in time, I would say accessing federal funds is maybe our best shot. And but if it doesn't go to Ways and Means, they can't put the limitation in and it can't happen.
Thank you, gentlemen. Oh, excuse me, Representative Dinkfelder.
I have one question regarding, because it doesn't specify in here at all as far as the purpose of the storage. Would it be for municipal, industrial, irrigation, or all of the above?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dinkfelder, the inventory would be consistent with the policies that the legislature has already established, and those emphasize multi-purpose reservoirs and really de-emphasize single-purpose. So, a good example of a multi-purpose reservoir would be something like Lost Creek down on the Rogue, where we use the storage capability that we had there to time releases based on weather forecasts in order to improve water temperature for the Chinook as they were moving up in the late summer. Really good example of using storage for fishery benefits.
Just one follow-up. I would also encourage you, I know a lot of this is going to involve data collection, because obviously a lot of municipalities who are working on expanding their water supplies have probably been doing some of this work, but also watershed councils throughout the state that are either in the process of doing their assessments, their watershed assessments, or many of them have already been completed, and water supply is one of the components that is looked at. I know in the Tualatin we looked at in-stream water for fish, and obviously they're looking at the Hag Lake, at expanding Hag Lake, and part of that is for in-stream reduction in temperature. So I'd encourage you to also, I think a lot of it for the department is, a lot of the information's out there, it's just going to be putting the database together and getting consistent information. Right. So I'd encourage you to also work with OWEB, because through their monitoring program, they've collected a lot of the assessment data, and you may even be able to tap into the work they're doing from all over the state.
Great recommendations. Thank you.
Yeah, I didn't hear a question, did I?
It wasn't a question. It was a comment.
Okay.
I didn't see a question there either.
I said follow-up.
Yeah.
Follow-up comments.
Assumed question.
Oh, so. Comments are welcome. But okay, with that, thank you very much for testimony here. Aubrey Russell from Oregon Trout has asked to come up and testify on this bill. Good morning.
Morning, Chair Jensen.
He sort of nodded like.
Oh. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Aubrey Russell. I'm with Oregon Trout. Oregon Trout would like to support this concept. We'd like to suggest that you might endorse an additional idea, which is as this bill goes forward, that it be accompanied by provision which would require Water Resources Department to work in cooperation with ODF&W to rank storage facilities in terms of their impact on fish and wildlife, on habitat destruction, the potential for fish passage. It's fitting that I think that we should be talking about this bill directly following 2138, the definition of recovery and the emphasis on habitat and the need for preserving habitat for wild fish, which, as we've heard, are the engine for recovery under the federal act. That's really the sum of my comments, if you have any questions.
Thank you, Aubrey. Any questions for Aubrey?
Thank you.
Do we have anybody else who would like to testify in this bill? Hey, Richard.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Richard Kosasan with Water for Life. A couple of follow-up comments. if one were to go back to the start, the intent, I think, behind Senate Bill 93, the intent was clearly solely oriented towards the development of additional storage sites. With water, you don't really have a lot of options. You use less, you conserve more, or you store more. Unless somebody else can find some more water, I think those are basically the alternatives. But again, the intent behind Senate Bill 93 when it was started was clearly the development, identification of storage sites throughout the state of Oregon. I think I would, this might be the first time I ever disagreed with the director of the department. He indicated that this was tied to a supply and stewardship program, and I would argue that the two are very much segregated. They are not linked. They should not be linked. But before this bill were to go to Ways and Means, I think people should look at existing statutes in terms of, we have statutes in 536-238, which address the development of environmentally acceptable, financially feasible, multi-purpose water storage facilities. We have provisions dealing with the formulation of state water resources in terms of 536-300, basically directing the commission to develop a program specifically stating existing water resources of the state means the methods of conserving and augmenting such water resources existing and contemplated needs. So we're talking about augmentation and storage. If you look at 536-310 provisions in that statute, dealing again with the augmentation of existing supplies for all beneficial purposes. If one were to look at 536-430, directing the commission to devise plans and programs for the development of water resources. Specifically, language contained in that states the development of water resources for the state in such a manner to encourage, promote, and secure maximum beneficial use and control thereof. If you would continue with the authority granted the commission in 536-440, wide open authority in terms of gathering information, investigation, surveys, and studies, including hearings relating to the water resources of the state to facilitate and assist in carrying out functions provided by law. So I think that the authority is granted to the department and the commission. This, in terms of legislation, I hope this would be coordinated with existing provisions. I think we've kind of got a variety of different provisions that maybe perhaps could be better coordinated. And I would hope that the committee would take a look at that and encourage Ways and Means to move forward on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Of course, the one thing that is not included in the cited statutes that you give us is the dollars. Which is pretty fundamental to the whole thing. Thank you very much. I appreciate you. There is a fairly extensive body of law statutes, as Richard indicates, that indicate that the state has an obligation to pursue, this area. And there was, I remember the hearings on it, both in Ways and Means and in Policy Committee, when it was part of the department's stewardship program that they were advancing. The difficulty we have right now is it is going to take time, and time is not something that the department claims to have a lot of excess of. They claim to be overworked and underpaid. And okay. Any other testimony on this bill? Representative Cruz.
Paul, could you come back?
up for a minute. Just in reference to what Mr. Kosasan said, I'm wondering if we have that many references in the ORS to basically the same sort of thing, would this be an opportunity to kind of do a cleanup and a consolidation, or is that... Well, I mean, it seemed to me, in listening to his sites, it's kind of like we've, over time, taken similar approaches to the same sort of thing, and I'm wondering if that sort of complication actually might make your job harder, or and maybe not, but I'm just right. wondering if we're going to move something like this, if it's one of the things I always like to look for is opportunities to reduce the body of law, if indeed that's possible, to make it a little more understandable to farm boys like me, so have you taken a look at that, or
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, I would not suggest a recodification of Oregon water law at this stage, but down the road, obviously, what you want to do is make sure that you've got as clear a direction as possible in the statutes. And I think what this does is it directs a specific activity, it establishes a time frame, and it establishes that you know it's going to take some money to do it, and you know the way it comes out will probably be go find the money and then get this done.
Thank you, Paul. I guess, Mr. Chair, that might be a body of work for your interim committee.
that would seem like a topic that would take the full interim to...
five interims.
Chair, please. Representative Shoffman.
So what we're doing is we're giving the chair, the director, direction to go do this, and hopefully... finding a way to fund it, but then you would also be able to use this to go back to those statutes cited and actually carry some of them out that has been sitting in those dusty books too then, correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffer, yes, that's correct. It's a tool for us to implement a number of the overarching policies.
Thank you.
And that would have been, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, the intent of the bill was to be a tool for the rest of the policies that are in statute.
Right.
Thank you. No one else to testify on House Bill 2366. We'll close the public hearing on that and open a public hearing on House Bill 2456.
House Bill 2456 modifies provision relating to voluntary program for allocation of conserved water, allows person or group of persons implementing measures prior to application for allocation of conserved water to apply for allocation of measure if measure was implemented within 5 years of application, declares emergency effective on passage.
That's it. Okay. We have three people signed up to testify on this. Doug Myers with Water Watch, please. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair. My name is Doug Myers, and I'm here testifying on behalf of Water Watch. The written testimony says that I'm Karen Russell, but please don't believe it. She's unable to be here today, so I'm doing it.
The chair recognizes
the difference.
A little less, difference. So. Yes.
Water Watch supports this bill. Karen Russell. The reason she's here is not here is that she's an acting executive director and has a very busy life outside of that. So we support the bill. We were part of the work group. Karen was part of that work group. Came out of the Senate Bill 93 task force of last session. The only thing we have and is in the drafting in the last paragraph. There were shall was replaced by may on two sites. One is page 2, line 42 of the bill, and on page 3, line 20 of the bill. We would like to see those mays on both of those lines changed to shall.
Those lines again, Doug?
It's in the testimony. It's at page 2, line 42. Page 3, line 20. It's in the about the middle of the last paragraph of Karen's testimony, those sites. And then we give some fancy legal sites for why it should be shall rather than may in there. But shall is, when you say somebody shall do something, that's sort of mandatory. If you say may, it's discretionary, in our opinion, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me, if you
say somebody shall do something, that's mandatory. If you say somebody may do something, that's discretionary.
Do you understand, of course, that there's a difference of opinion on that as far as legislative counsel is concerned?
I think legislative counsel is here, and I'll wait until they are,
and we'll bring them up now.
Great,
Brendan, if you would.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy with Legislative Council. I did, in drafting this measure, make a few changes. I guess this gets back to our conflict from last session regarding the difference between may not and shall not. I believe that there are problems with this bill and the way I drafted it, but not in locations that Ms. Russell has pointed out. Or, in this case, Mr. Myers. the change in, as she has pointed out in the testimony, to page 2, line 42, is a may not. And additionally, in the line 20 of page 3 is a may not. It is the opinion of our office, and this is the way we've been doing business now for the past several years, is that shall not is a prohibition, but may not is a actual removal of permission. The distinction being that shall not may carry with it a tone of future possibilities, future restrictions, but is not an actual restriction in and of itself. The arguments were made before I was a member of the office and settled, and that is the opinion of the office, and I will stick with it. I believe there was a bill passed last session which said that regardless of whether it says may not or shall not, they mean the same thing. I think that's in Chapter 174 now. However,
Brandon.
Sir.
I believe there's been a fairly consistent effort, hasn't there, on the part of at least the committees that I've been on, where the wording comes up, even if it's not addressed by the proponents of the bill, to make those corrections or make those changes.
Chair Jensen, that is correct. We do make those changes even in the light-based material of a section. If the section is reprinted in the bill, we do make the change from a shall not to a may not. Similarly, we generally change no person shall to a person may not. However, that being said, in Section 5, line 31, the addition that I was asked to make the priority date either the same as or 1 minute after. Perhaps I got a little overzealous, and that would be perfectly appropriate in that situation. If the proponents of the bill would like a change to remove that may and put it back to shall, I see no problem in that.
The chair, has he heard the discussion prior to coming in today that this was an issue coming up, looked over the bill and requests that that amendment be made for us on line 31.
Okay.
I think if I can, Mr. Myers, if I can, we certainly appreciate Water Watch's, support of the bill with these exceptions. If I can try to leave you to carry back to Karen and others the fact that this is the position legislative council has taken, and it's not my position to here argue with them, and I strongly suspect if you get six attorneys in the room you are likely to wind up with a 3-3 vote on this, but I do think our statute should be consistent, and at least the court would look at, I believe, what the intent of the legislature has been in this area, and if a case came up and it were argued, and Brendan, correct me if I'm mistaken on this, but I believe the court would be inclined to look at the advice that was given the legislature about the use of those two words, so that the intent of the committees and the intent of the legislature, was consistent with that. Is that correct, Brendan?
Generally, yes.
I understand the difficulty of predicting what the court will agree to or not agree to, but okay.
And Mr. Chair, I will relay those sentiments,
please,
of yours to Karen Russell and to Kimberly Priestley, and along with Mr. McCarthy's phone number.
Yeah.
And they can have a 111 vote, actually.
And they're certainly welcome to call the chair if they wish to on this issue, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And now we have Adam Sussman and Paul Clary again, who have been the highlight of most of our presentations today. I guess Adam is not going to venture up.
No.
There must be some technical glitches in this one that he doesn't want to be up there for.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, Paul Clary again, Director of the Oregon Water Resource Department. I remember my mom always correcting me on the difference between may I and can I. My dad kind of cut through the shall not and may not with just no. But after listening to this discussion, I think I made the right decision not going to law school. The bill in front of us today House Bill 2456, again, is a bill that came out of our Senate Bill 93 task force. I won't go through the details on that task force on this bill, but just talk a little bit about the allocation of conserved water program, which was originally passed in 1987, modified by the legislature in 1993 and 1997. It's a voluntary program intended to provide water users an incentive to implement conservation measures. Under the program, conservation projects benefit both water right holders as well as in-stream values. Prior to this law being passed, water users who improved their water use efficiency and conserved water weren't entitled to use any of the water. We were very much a strict use it or lose it. If you didn't apply everything, you couldn't save water and spread it elsewhere. This bill, when it was passed in 87 and then later modified, provided an opportunity for water users to spread a portion of the saved water to either a new use or onto new land. So it kind of both provided an incentive for conservation and removed the disincentive under the more traditional use it or lose it statute. the revisions that were made in 93 and 97 were critical to expansion of this program. Early on, we didn't see a lot of applications, but after 97 in particular, we're starting to see more and more come in. I think we get 5-6 or so a year now. It's a growing program. It's a particular interest in certain parts of the state that have got real opportunities to implement conservation practices both on farm and particularly in the transmission area. Central Oregon in particular is an area where there's some real opportunities to line and pipe canals and do other things that really save a substantial amount of water. What this bill would do is make permanent the current ability of an applicant to choose the priority date for the conserved water rights. Now, this is my PowerPoint display. This is pretend an original water right with 5 CFS in it. They go through a conserved water allocation project, and they've got 2 CFS over here that now is conserved water. The priority date for this original right stays the same. What this bill does is allow the applicant to make the priority date for these 2 CFS either the same as this one or a minute later, which means if there's a shortage, the original right gets all the water, the conserved right doesn't get any water. And since the conserved right is sometimes transferred to another user, and certainly a portion of it's transferred in stream, there's some people that are not going to fund conservation practices if they become second priority. And so that's the purpose of this change. And it's one that we think has really encouraged the program to proceed. It was a temporary provision. It's going to be sunset here July 1, 2003. This bill makes that provision permanent. It also makes permanent a provision to allow us to look back 5 years on conserved water practices and bring them forward under this program. That would be consistent with our presumption of forfeiture. If you've not used water at least once every 5 years, there's a presumption that you forfeited that right. This allows us to go back and recapture that period, and again, it's a sunset provision that we need to make permanent. It finally makes a few minor modifications in wording. Right now, we're required to have a certificate for the water right that's involved in the allocation of conserved water, which means that we have to go through all the process to get the water rights certificate, and then we end up breaking it up into two things and issuing two new certificates. Under our normal transfer process, we've got an approach that's called proof to the satisfaction of the director. We don't actually issue the document. We get everything done to that point, and we're proposing to be allowed to take that same approach with allocation of conserved water. So again, improve the consistency on how we deal with transfers. And then finally, change the word from conservation proposal to conservation application to make it clear that all we're reviewing is the allocation of the water, not the actual practice itself. Usually the funding entities, be they NRCS or Bureau of Reclamation or whatever, are the ones that review the actual project itself. So we don't know of any known support to the program. It'll provide greater flexibility and incentive for water right holders to implement conservation measures, and those are measures that we think benefit both out-of-stream and in-stream uses.
Mr. Chair, Paul, I think you meant to say you don't know of any opposition to the program. You said you didn't know of any support. I just wanted to make sure that on the record we were saying the right thing. So.
No. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? I think... that'll be all. I think you're about to find out who the opposition is, so we'll move to Roger Martin, who is representing the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation this morning with the comments that they may have on this. Good morning, Roger.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the lobbyist for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and I want to start off by saying I approach you with fear and trepidation We are not, I'm not stating opposition. I'm raising an issue that was brought to me by the hydrologist for the tribe and a concern that you will see in front of me that she's voiced. This is an intertribal memo that was sent to me, and it was the best thing I could do to give you all the information. And the if you look at it, it's addressed to Lisa Gunny-Wallace. Lisa is the tribal legislative coordinator, and we work directly with her. The information there, and the statement is made, this bill has good intentions, but if implemented over time, ultimately will lead to disastrous results for in-stream flows. I would start right off by telling you, I don't know as much about water as at least several of you do, and I don't want to even get into an argument about water. I'm wearing a golf tie today, and it reminds me of the axiom that if you're not a good golfer, I qualify. You're more likely to get advice from less expert golfers than you are from expert golfers. Expert golfers are smart enough to keep their mouth shut, won't advise you unless you ask. The ones without any experience are always giving their opinion to you. Several of you, and Representative Jensen and Representative Tomei, have been on the reservation and have observed the reason we may be overly concerned about this is that the Umatilla River probably is the best example of things go disastrously wrong on a historic basis. 80 years ago, all anadromous fish runs, for all intents and purposes, perished in the Umatilla River because of overutilization for irrigation. And the river was virtually sterile, especially for all salmon. There may have been remnant steelhead runs, but for almost all salmon, for about 80 years. And in the last 15 years, the tribe, working in tremendous cooperation with the federal government, the state of Oregon, have reinvigorated and reestablished fish runs. And we look at it as a great achievement, and that was done by lessening the amount of irrigation water that went out. So whenever anybody talks about the possibility of lessening stream flows, we become very concerned. I'm going to leave the experts to come back to me and say her figures are wrong. I've already talked to the chairman, who said he's a little dubious about this being kind of a worst-case scenario. And we're experienced with worst-case scenarios, so that's why we bring it up. Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to get the advice of the department, of you, and anybody else in the room, that I can go back and discuss this with the tribe. But I wanted to put this information before you, the concerns they raise.
Okay. Any questions for Roger?
Well,
Representative Kurtz.
Not necessarily for Roger, but maybe more for Paul, and because there's a point here that's brought up, and I'm thinking back to, I think it was 97, when there was a hot issue with the Grants Pass Irrigation District and the fact that their canals leak so much. But the fact also was that where the canals were going, they had basically turned a desert into a garden because of all the leakage. So obviously there's issues of groundwater recharge in this, and I mean, you were talking about the efficiency of of lining and right. and piping and all that. So does that? Well, and clearly in the Grants Pass case, historically, I mean, there was no water there and nothing grew there, but it's that irrigation district's been in place for so long that that's kind of the natural environment now. So, I mean, do those kind of dynamics come into play here?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, yes, they do. As you know, we don't create water, we don't destroy it, we just affect the timing of when it's taken out of the system or when it's reintroduced in the system. And the current statute, you'll see on the bottom of page 2, line 45, requires us to basically do an injury analysis. It says, after determining the quantity of conserved water, if any, required to mitigate the effects on other water rights. So where we've got these in-stream water rights or other downstream, out-of-stream users, we have to first evaluate, is the conserved water portion going to injure other water rights? And if it does, we have to come up with a mitigation program. Because as was indicated here, particularly in areas where we've got this real direct and immediate hydraulic connection between the groundwater and the surface water, we can end up robbing Peter to pay Paul. And so what we try to do is mitigate the effects and affect the timing so we're putting water in stream or leaving it in stream when it's most critical to fish, and maybe what we're robbing is some of the peak flows or the winter flows that aren't as critical.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chair? I mean, clearly, if you have an irrigation district, they're building new canals, they're diverting water through different means. You know, peak efficiency absolutely would make sense, but I guess my concern is where we've had a system in place, even though it's not a natural system per se, but it's been in place long enough that it's had an impact in that area, that would be taken in, you know, Grants Pass as a prime example here, that would have to be taken into consideration, even though that groundwater supply that's happening in the Grants Pass area isn't not naturally occurring and wouldn't be happening if the canals weren't there.
Right. Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, what we take into account is injury to other water rights. You know, what you're asking about is do water right holders have an entitlement to, if you would, waste, and you know, obviously they don't. We've got the requirement that any, you know, you've got beneficial use, but it's all beneficial use without waste. That becomes a big issue, though, and you know, where we've got groundwater recharge that then is being used by wells that have got water rights on it, it's one of the things that we take into account.
Well, yeah. And because clearly, I mean, you know, it all ends up, I mean, all water ends up in the ocean eventually, so it's all hydraulically connected one way or another, and I guess I would think there would be a point where a canal system almost becomes historic precedent for wherever it is. You know, if you've got something that's been in place for 50 years and it's had this environmental impact, to suddenly shift the way that system is operating would might not have absolutely the best results, I would think. I don't know if this kind of getting at the
right
concerns of the tribe here or not. I think it's...
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, I think as the tribes indicated, they're concerned about the impact of the recharge that reached back into the river. You may be talking about the impact of the recharge that reaches other wells or provides water for riparian vegetation and so forth. There's a number of reasons, though, to look at improving efficiencies, and both in terms of affecting the timing of the water and being able to use a delivery system to push water all the way down. If you're losing half of the water that you're diverting, you've got some folks down at the end of the ditch that aren't real happy, and so there's some encouragement there as well. If it were easy, we'd have it all figured out by now.
Good point.
Representative Chaffee.
Thank you. So if I just get this clear, if this passes, it'll be taken under consideration.
Yeah.
Their fisheries,
right,
aren't going to be negatively impacted. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffer, we've got the requirement to take into account that injury to those existing water rights and wherever we've got in-stream water rights for fisheries, and we've got them all around the state, we've got to take that into account. We can't injure them, right? And obviously, because so much of this, when you get in large projects, you primarily are going to be looking at federal funding sources, and they've got, you know, both the NEPA requirements and the consultation requirements to go through. So there's a lot of belts and suspenders to ensure that we're not impacting fisheries.
Thank you. Paul. Just a question and observation. This whole body of law, like a good part of the water resource law in this state, is pretty disjointed and convoluted. And in fact, we are talking about, in this bill, amending, in essence, a group of ORSs that were enacted, what, back in 97 or, you know, something?
Originally 1987.
Well, yeah.
Modified in
537,
yeah.
445, et cetera.
Right.
That have never been on, I mean, that have never really been law. because they were being because we had another body of law which preceded that that had to sunset before these became law. Is that correct?
These were what we're enacting here is the making permanent those provisions that are going to sunset. And you'll look in the statute and you've got basically two laws sitting there, because if this bill doesn't pass, the other one automatically kicks back
That's
in.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so basically, I think there is the part that we had, a question and concern we had, was that there are some problems with the law, and this bill is intended to fix those problems. And I thought that was the way your testimony, had gone. So the tribe's concern on this, if that is a real concern, is to come in and propose deleting this whole section on water conservation, because the water conservation is going to be there whether this bill passes or not.
Right.
But it'll be but the department's contention is that this will be a fairer issue than it would have been had it not passed and we operated under the previous law that never has been in effect. Now, that doesn't make sense until you spend a couple hours in the morning before you come to committee looking through the ORS to, you know, try to figure out what's going on. So that, I think, is the message that we need to get back to the tribes, that we really aren't inventing water conservation here. We're trying to improve the existing statute, and if they have the real concern about water conservation, then they need to bring forth a bill to do away with this whole, all of these chapters or all of these sections of the ORSs. Is that, am I...
Chair Jensen, that's a good point, that the concern about the impact of conservation practices on streams, on wells, on other users, has been around since 1987, and it's part of the basic bill. So it's this bill doesn't resolve that one way or another, but if the concern is that you don't want to see these practices going forward, as you indicated, what probably ought to be done is taking this law off of the books.
And Roger, I'd be happy to meet with you and the tribes to discuss this, because if it sounds complicated, it probably is, and we might even have to bring the department in to back up the chair a little bit on his kind of anemic knowledge of water law.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it very much. It's probably, with budget conditions the way they are, nobody can take a field trip to explain all this, but since the state representative for the tribe is the chairman of this committee, I think we'll work it out.
Okay. Any other questions?
Chairman, Mr. Chair, just my comment earlier on the work of your interim committee, I think you just made that point even clearer.
Thank you, Representative. I was hoping for a soft interim this time.
Yeah, it will be. Just water law. No big deal.
Okay, no big deal. Anything else for the good of the order? Oh, let's see. I have a need to close the public hearing on House Bill 2456. And a need to open a public hearing on House Bill 2268 for the purposes of entering in the record written testimony related to this measure from Water Watch and Mr. Ed Hendricks. These are testimonies that you received last Thursday when we were in committee.
One of them said the other thing.
Yeah, they got them in too, because I had them. And, you know, with that, then, we will close the public hearing on 2268, and once having done that, we are adjourned.
Okay.
Too bad I wasn't here to help.
Been here.